Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the first episode of the week of the Calcio Land podcast. So today we're going to recap what happened in Serie A. Since it's Monday, we're going to give our winners and losers. We're going to give our reaction to the Champions League draw. And we're going to answer some great Twitter questions from our listeners. Today we don't have a guest. We've had a great streak of them, but today you'll get more of Alex, who's joining me for the first segment. Alex, as you guys know, is our producer, co-host. His videos and tweets on Chelsea continue to blow up. So, Alex, today at the top, I wanted to talk a little bit about the upcoming transfer market, talk about Chelsea and Napoli potentially meeting in the Europa League, which would be quite the juicy match, and react with the Champions League draw. But, you know, January window's around the corner. One of the slogans on our podcast is come for the transfer news, a stay for the calcio. So let's talk to maybe people that are tuning in to listen more on transfer. So Serie A, you know, has a lot of players that a lot of clubs outside of Italy would love to have. And I would say three of the biggest jewels in Serie A right now are Koulibaly, Dybala, and Icardi. So Alex, break out your crystal ball. If you had to guess, which of these three is going to stay at their current club the longest?
Yeah, it's a good question, David, and I would love to know this because then I would place a wager or break news myself. But no, I think logically I'm going to say Koulibaly, but I'll explain my reasoning behind that. Now, first off, Icardi and Dybala are the same age. They're both 25, but more importantly, they're attackers versus Koulibaly being a center back. So when you look at someone like Dybala, I know he's not necessarily having the season he would want to have or necessarily Juve fans would expect from him, but albeit Juve are still Juve, and Dybala knows that if you're going to be on Juventus, you're part of the system, really. Even Ronaldo, a certain extent, is part of the system. But I know many people have been thinking for a while now, maybe Dybala will go somewhere else. Barcelona used to be rumored. Maybe he'll go somewhere else and kind of be able to spread his wings a little bit more. I still see that totally being possible. But like I said, he's 25. So I think he could easily make that move when he's 27. And it could be just as impactful and just as meaningful because that's still the very prime of your career. And I don't think he'll ever be totally phased out at Juve where his value really is down and people don't want him. He's always going to be wanted. He's quite the talent. Now, Icardi, even more so, I feel like Icardi might be the first to leave out of those three. Now, a couple factors there. Icardi, of course, has a striker now behind him, Lautaro Martinez. Now, that would be an audacious move if Inter just outright made Martinez the striker, but they do have a little bit of a backup plan. And sure, Real Madrid might want a future star, a striker, maybe Bayern Munich once Lewandowski goes his way. Everybody's kind of looking for a striker, and I just feel like Icardi rumors of him leaving, whether the rumors have been credible or not, kind of have legs to them to a certain extent. So I could kind of see Icardi leaving this summer, and then Dybala leaving maybe after next year. But with Koulibaly, despite the rumors with Koulibaly, David, I want to go to the line that you always use about managers. It's really easy to get rid of a manager, but it's so much harder trying to replace that manager and find someone better. So look at Koulibaly. Where is a conceivable replacement for Koulibaly? We have friends of the show, guests of the show, saying that Koulibaly might be the most important and best Napoli player since Maradona. And we know how De Laurentiis operates. He's not exactly just going to give away players just because he feels like it or he could get money in return. He really is stubborn and stingy in terms of getting rid of players. But once again, where's the backup plan? It's not Maximovic. He's a good player. He's 27. He's a good center back, but he is not the person who's going to step in for Koulibaly. He's already playing. Where is that next center back? And until I hear that they're in for Matthias De Ligt or a Skriniar from Inter, which I doubt would ever happen, or just another young stud center back, I don't think they can get rid of Koulibaly as much as they could get in return for him. So I'm going to say Koulibaly stays the longest out of Icardi and Dybala because A, it's Napoli. Napoli do not let go of players easily. But B, where the heck is the backup plan? I think it's a lot easier to maybe bring in a new attacker for Dybala or Icardi than it is to bring in a new center back for Koulibaly. So, David, that's my stance. What about you?
So, Alex, I agree a lot with a lot of what you said, and especially the market for center backs. And we've seen in recent years the prices skyrocket. It used to be that teams were willing to spend a fortune for goal scorers, but teams started realizing that there were a lot more really good attackers on the transfer market as opposed to elite defenders. And this is why we've seen the prices really go up. So let's look at them one by one. And by the way, I'm going to start off by saying I would be absolutely shocked if anyone of these three players leaves in the January window. Like, it would really beyond shock me. Like, nothing's impossible anymore on the transfer market, but I think these players are at least finishing the season and likely staying long term. When I think of Dybala, you know, what's really interesting is when he joined Juve, this was a few years ago, Juve was still a club that was seen as easy picking on the transfer market. We knew about the player's will. It almost felt like a matter of time after Dybala had his great first season at Juve that the countdown was on when Dybala would leave. But we've seen Juve really raise the bar. And the Ronaldo signing for me really changed how Juve is perceived also on the transfer market. But Dybala has also never hidden the fact that he would like to play in La Liga someday. You know, maybe he can be Messi's heir apparent at Barcelona and they play together one season. So I wouldn't exclude that. I would say of the three, he's probably, to me, the likeliest to potentially leave in a few seasons. Also, because you look at Juve, they already have Bernardeschi on the squad, someone that they believe significantly in. Icardi, he actually, of all these three players, is the one that has an exit clause. And when you look at, you know, his ability and what strikers are going for, 110 million, doesn't even sound that outrageous to me. As you mentioned, he's just starting his prime. We saw Icardi do really well in the Champions League. But he seems very happy in Milan, also for family reasons. His wife, Wanda Nara, is also now a TV personality in Italy. We know the situation with the kids, with Maxi Lopez. So with Icardi, it's also a matter outside of football. And let's also be honest, Icardi stayed when Inter was considerably worse. Like, they were in the Champions League this season. They look in very good shape to go back next season, and he's about to sign a new contract. So Koulibaly as well, we know how important he is to Napoli, as you pointed out, how difficult it is for clubs to negotiate with him. And more importantly, he seems really thrilled to be there. He was the captain yesterday. He really enjoyed it. So short of Koulibaly really pushing for a move, I just don't see it. So I'm going to say Dybala, the likeliest to leave. And I would say Koulibaly and Icardi is really a toss-up. So the other thing I wanted to ask you, Alex, is we saw Napoli were eliminated in the Champions League. They're going back down to the Europa League. And Ancelotti, in the pre-match press conference before he faced Cagliari, talked about the possibility of facing his former club, Chelsea, who also happens to have Napoli's former manager, Sarri. So, of course, they can't control the draw, but you've been following closely the Europa League with Chelsea. Your videos and analysis are really popular. So give me kind of your take on the landscape and the Europa League. Do you see Chelsea and Napoli as clear favorites for this competition?
Almost clear favorites. Yeah, I would say they're the two best teams in the competition. Now, of course, all of this analysis I'm about to give or just answer is based on Eden Hazard being at Chelsea past the January transfer window. And then, of course, for Napoli, Koulibaly would have to be there as well. But I'm going to assume
I would say both things are very, very safe.
Yes. So assuming both of those players are there, yes, those are the two best teams in the competition. I'm very sure of it. Now, it also is just ironic because of, as you mentioned, the ties between Napoli and Chelsea right now. But other teams that I give a shot in terms of at least looking at the landscape, seeing the draw, of course, Napoli have Zurich and Chelsea have Malmo as their first opponents in the knockout phase. So you'd like to think Napoli and Chelsea will handle those opponents fine, especially since I think both teams are going to be taking the Europa League more seriously this year. But then you got to look at an Arsenal who are pretty good this year. They have a new manager as well, just like Chelsea, Unai Emery. And I got to be honest, I think he had a much tougher task than some people may have realized when he got that job. And I think he's been pretty good. They're definitely an electric team. I wouldn't say they necessarily have a foundation that a Chelsea does or a Napoli does in terms of their structure, and there's not as much solidity. But Arsenal can be potent with Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang and Lacazette and Mesut Ozil. They can be potent. They certainly can. So if you catch them on a good day, you could really be burned. So Arsenal, I'll definitely throw at least into the conversation. And then, David, it's funny, a team that, of course, is in Serie A, Lazio, is facing Sevilla in the knockout phase. Now, Lazio, I don't mean to slight them. I'm not too scared of them in the Europa League. Also, they're really going to be trying to finish top four in Serie A, but maybe they'll take both evenly. But Sevilla, let's not overlook Sevilla at all. Sevilla have some success in their history in the Europa League. And also, newsflash, I can't believe this is true, but they're second right now in La Liga. They're not that far behind Barcelona. So, hey, maybe that'll impact them and they'll be so focused on league that they won't really do well in the Europa League. But I don't think Sevilla is a team that you can all overlook. So I would say Napoli and Chelsea are definitely the favorites. I would say Arsenal's fairly close behind, and then I'd put Sevilla fourth. And really beyond that, I just don't see many Cinderella teams, as some may say. Shakhtar can always be dangerous. Benfica has a good history of doing decent in the Europa League. But honestly, I think it's Napoli or Chelsea's to lose. And if you're placing bets, just cover all the bets. Just bet on Napoli, Chelsea, Arsenal, and Sevilla. And I really feel like you should walk away with some money. So, David, that's my prediction. Of course, I would love to see Napoli and Chelsea play each other. That would be absolutely amazing. But, David, I want to ask, I just talked about the Europa League draw. What did you make of the Champions League draw?
Yeah, and a lot of good points you made on the Europa League. Just want to add that compared to last season, I think Napoli is going to take it much more seriously. They basically punted it last year for two reasons. A, last season, they were in a legit title race against Juve. This season doesn't feel like that will be the case, despite the fact that Napoli only has one less point than this time last year, but Juve is just steamrolling them. But more importantly, Napoli is going to lose the points and the ranking from the coefficient from when Benitez took them to the semifinal of the Europa League. So they have to do well, because if not, they'll find themselves in another group of death of the Champions League next season. So I think Napoli is going to be very motivated. So speaking of the Champions League draw, I think for Juve it went probably as bad as it could have by getting Atletico Madrid. I guess you could make an argument Liverpool would have been just as bad, but I think Juve likes a little bit better an offensive team that they can do some counters on. Like, Juve and Atletico are very similar teams. So I think this was a very tough draw for Juve. I think in general, in recent years, Juve hasn't had the best luck in the round of 16 and beyond in the draws. But, you know, if Juve wants to win the Champions League, you have to beat the best teams at some point. And maybe having Atletico over two matches helps Juve a little bit more than a single match in the final, because that would have also been in Atletico's home stadium. So I guess if they were going to be in your way to win the Champions League, maybe it's better to face them now. Roma, on the other hand, just goes to show how important luck can be in the Champions League. It couldn't have gone any better for them with Porto. So as our friend Matteo Bonetti tweeted, it's not out of the question that we see another great run in the Champions League for Roma. Quite frankly, they've seemed more inspired in general in Europe than in Serie A. So that's going to be quite interesting. So we look forward to covering that.
Yeah, I definitely kind of got a chuckle when I saw Juve draw Atletico Madrid, because in many ways, they're two of the most systematic teams there are. And I don't mean this as a slight. I have a hard time believing that's going to be an entertaining matchup, Atletico Madrid-Juve. I feel like it might be very stagnant. But what's not stagnant is our winners and losers segment, David. We just had a wonderful weekend of Serie A. So without further ado, who are winners and losers for episode 178 of the Calcio Land podcast?
Okay, so we're recording this on Monday afternoon. Lazio and Atalanta have yet to play. Milan and Bologna have yet to play. So these are just the matches we've seen so far. So I think Inter beating Udinese at home 1-0 in and of itself wouldn't be reason really to celebrate, but Inter absolutely had to have that game after the elimination in the Champions League, losing to Juve. Not winning that match would have been really quite disastrous for them. Icardi scored off a penalty. He's about to get an extension as well, so he's a winner as well. Let's move on to Torino-Juve. This was a very close match. I thought Torino's defense was really brilliant. So although they lost the match, we want to give a shout out to their three center back, Izzo and Carlo and Gigi. I thought they were really excellent in this match. On Juve, yeah, Ronaldo scored the penalty kick. But for me, once again, Mandzukic is the clutch player for Juve. He got the penalty kick. He had scored the game winner against Inter the week before. So in Juve's two derbies, the Derby d'Italia against their biggest rival and the derby of their city, Mandzukic comes through. What a surprise. On Sampdoria, we had Quagliarella, who's now scored 7 goals in 8 matches in their win against Parma. I really think Mancini has to call him to the Italian national team. I know he's older, but every game counts for Italy with the ranking and the qualification. So I would have him on there as well. Last week, we talked about Sassuolo struggling a little bit. They had only 1 win in 9 games. They finally win a match this week, so that's their second win in 10 matches. They've struggled without Prince Boateng, but this was an important win for them. Another player we've had in the loser section for a lot of times is Fiorentina striker Simeone. He scored for second consecutive game. He looks to be getting back on track. Fiorentina also hadn't won since, I think, late September, so they win the derby against Empoli despite falling behind. Then we had Napoli, their match against Cagliari. Our friend Thousand Names sent out a tweet before it saying, everything about this game looks like a draw. I'm never wrong. Let's see what happens. He came pretty close, but Milik with his late goal with that beautiful free kick. I know Milik is going to be remembered a lot for that miss against Liverpool, and I saw that more as a Milik miss than a Alisson save, which was still an impressive save, but Milik should have put that away. But in Serie A, he's been sensational. He has a goal every 101 minutes in the league. I think that's the best average right there. And then we had Roma's win against Genoa. It wasn't pretty, but Di Francesco really needed those 3 points. We had Kluivert scoring his first goal in Serie A. We had Zaniolo put in another strong performance there. For Genoa, on the flip side, we had Piontek scored his first goal in a run of play. He had scored off 2 penalties since Ballardini left. So maybe Prandelli can get him going. I thought Genoa probably deserved a little bit more in that match. So now let's flip to the losers. To me, the biggest loser of the weekend has to be Simone Zaza. He only has 1 goal this season. He's really struggled. He hasn't helped Belotti. Against his former team, he creates that dumb penalty. Really a tough season for him, because to me, he really threw away a Mazzarri masterpiece. I was really impressed with the way Torino contained Juve. So Zaza, our biggest loser of the week. Then we have Frosinone manager Longo, who's on the hot seat as of now. We're not sure if he's going to get sacked or not. The fans contested Frosinone after the home loss to Sassuolo. They weren't impressed with the team's disposition. Longo said he'll stay as long as the club doesn't fire him. I understand he wants to make sure he gets paid, but that was disappointing by Frosinone. And then we had in the Roma match, we had Olsen, who had 2 really horrible mistakes. One of them was saved by VAR. The other one wasn't saved by VAR. I like to say he pulled a Handanovic, where inexplicably a goalkeeper doesn't take action. It's kind of like when you play FIFA on the PlayStation where the controller's battery just dies on you and you give up a silly goal. That's what it felt like. But for me, other than Zaza, the biggest loser of the weekend has to be VAR. We've said it on the podcast before. There was the possibility that now the arbitrary nature of when VAR is applied is creating more controversy than a decision, you know, that happened in the pre-VAR world where there wasn't the replay. Now I feel like the referees have this tool to help themselves make the right decision. We saw quite a few questionable decisions in the Torino-Juve match and the Roma-Genoa match. And so Genoa president Preziosi said that the fix was in because they didn't want the Roma fans to riot. So they had set it up so that Roma would win. And look, again, it creates controversy because you have this tool and you're not using it. So I think Serie A really needs to look at this. Last season, it felt like it was applied more frequently. There was maybe some complaints that the games were lasting longer. But guess what? There's a lot more complaining when the calls are done wrong. And one thing that's never wrong is when our listeners send in Twitter questions for the podcast. So we have some usual Serie A questions, and we also have a couple of music and movie questions, which you guys know that I love. So please use the CalcioLand hashtag. Also, for you movie fans, we are going to record an interview with our great friend Andrew Barker from Variety, where we'll talk about Inter and year-end movies. So if you have questions for Andrew on both Inter or movies, please send them with the CalcioLand hashtag. And which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right, David, this is an interesting one to start off with. What did you make of Nedved's comments about Morata maybe not being a Juventino?
So let's set the context. So Morata was announced as Inter's new CEO on Friday. It was his first official match at Inter in the stands against Udinese. Before the match, he was asked if he felt the situation at Inter right now is better or worse than when he took over at Juve. And he said the situation at Juve was worse. I think it's hard to argue that. Juve was coming off back-to-back seventh-place finishes. Inter's in the Champions League. Now, Inter has FFP, but they are getting out of that this season. So I think it's safe to say that, you know, Inter's situation is better. So I'm not sure if that was seen as kind of the first shot fired. If it is, okay, I want to report it. But then Nedved was asked about watching Marotta in the stands celebrate when Inter won. And he said, look, Marotta's a great professional, but maybe he was never a Juventino. So here's my take on it. Just because something is true, and I think it's certainly possible that Marotta isn't a Juve fan growing up and all, maybe it's still not the appropriate thing to say. And I want to set the context. To me, it's one thing if a player pushes to move, like Bonucci or Vidal or Pogba. Those people left Juve because they wanted to. If it were up to Marotta, he would still be sitting alongside Nedved cheering on for Juve. So again, what Nedved say is probably true, but to me, you have to be really careful. Not surprisingly, it got picked up in the media. He was talked about a lot. Nedved was asked about it today at the Champions League draw, and he doubled down on there. But in my opinion, Marotta was kicked out at Juve. There's really no other way to put it. I wouldn't say it was the most elegant exit either. When it was announced that Marotta was leaving on Juve's official site, the only thing they wrote were his quotes announcing that at the next board meeting, he wouldn't be part of the management team moving forward. So, you know, we look in general at how some Juve legends have left. In my opinion, Nedved, you know, maybe if he just said, hey, it's weird to see Marotta at Inter, period, or even say, hey, you know, he won't win as much at Inter as he did at Juve. If he wants to take a shot at him there, I think taking a little bit of a personal shot to someone that you worked with side by side with a lot, that you won a lot with. And look, Marotta's been in the game for a while. I don't want to assume, but I have a feeling Marotta probably helped Nedved become a director. I thought it was a little bit unnecessary. I tweeted about it. Again, not surprisingly, a lot of Juve fans told me that I'm crazy. I'm making a big thing out of nothing. But, you know, to me, it wasn't the most elegant thing. And look, in the past, we've had Lippi and Trapattoni leave Juve for Inter. I could be wrong, but I never remember Boniperti or the Avvocato Agnelli saying something. Those guys aren't real Juventini. And I get that Calciopoli has happened after. So, you know, for me, Juve is just not the way they were kind of when I was growing up. You even look at Ronaldo after the penalty kick. I don't want to combine those two things, but just Juve is a little bit different than what we had under the Avvocato Agnelli. So I'm curious to see what people's take is on this. Maybe, you know, I'm overreacting to it. Look, you know, the rivalry between Juve and Inter is a good thing for Serie A, that there'll be bad blood. But I have a little bit of an issue of taking, you know, what comes off as a personal dig at someone. Because let's be honest, the ultra fanatical Juve fans that hate Inter now we're starting to call Marotta a traitor, and they're piggybacking on Nedved's comments. And to me, that's really unfortunate because, again, if it were up for Marotta, he would still be with Nedved cheering Juve. He's an older gentleman. I know some Juve fans are saying, well, you know, he should have just gone anywhere else, should have gone abroad, not gone to Inter. He's an older guy. He's used to Serie A. No other team was going to pay him well. I have no issue with him going Inter because, again, it was Juve that let him go. And to me, it's just unfortunate that now this Nedved comment is stoking the fire with some fans saying that, you know, he's a traitor. So enough on that. What's the next question, Alex?
All right, David, the next Twitter question is, what did you make of UEFA's ruling on Milan regarding financial fair play?
Okay, so I'm going to get back on another soapbox after the one that I had there on Marotta. So I'll tell you this. I'm not going to defend financial fair play in general. I think, you know, in a lot of ways it's caused, you know, maybe some unintended consequences. Maybe in some ways it's made the gap even bigger between the super rich club and others. But it's also really important to understand what financial fair play is there for in the first place. And this is something that I've learned from Gab Marcotti, who knows way more about financial fair play than I do. But he always says, look, financial fair play wasn't put in place to create a level playing field. It was put in place to make sure clubs don't go bankrupt. So don't look at financial fair play as something somewhat similar to, say, the salary cap in U.S. sports, because that's not what it is. Financial fair play is a set of guidelines put into place to make sure clubs don't go bankrupt. And I think for the most part, it has worked. And I'm going to give you a couple of examples. Like Roma, before Palotta was there, their debts were huge. Had Roma not been subjected to financial fair play and had an owner like Palotta that pumped some of his money but also was sensitive to financial fair play, other Roma would be bankrupt now. We've had two other clubs in Serie A, some major ones that in this millennium went bankrupt. Napoli, and this was before there was financial fair play. Even if there was financial fair play, Napoli wasn't playing in Europe at the time. So only clubs in Europe are subject to financial fair play. So they went bankrupt. Parma, not that long ago, went bankrupt. They weren't subjective to financial fair play. Had they been under the rules that Roma was under, there's no way they would have gone bankrupt because they just won't allow you to spend so much more than the revenues that you bring in. And the other thing, too, that I notice a lot with people talking about financial fair play is the focus is on the consequences. So people will say, well, how does it help a team to bridge the gap with Manchester City and PSG if you're limiting their squad and having them, you know, not spend too much? But there you're focusing on the punishment. That's like saying someone that's in jail saying, how can I get my life together when you send me to jail? It's like, dude, you were sent to jail so other people see that you can't do the behavior that sent you to jail. Like, that's why it happens. So I think we need to think, A, what financial fair play is there for, and B, realize why it happens. To me, in a lot of ways, financial fair play is like global warming. The name isn't the best. So every time, you know, people talk about global warming and then there's a really cold day, people are like, oh, what happened to global warming? It's freezing today. It's just two different things. So I think there's a lot of parallels to that. So back to Milan. I think we can all agree that the year of Fassone and Mirabelli, where they spent like $250 million with an ownership group that had no money, like that's the quickest recipe for bankruptcy for any club. It's just completely unsustainable. So financial fair play, they got a fine, $12 million fine. They have a limited squad in the Europa League, and they have 3 years to balance the budget. So that punishment isn't to kind of help Milan get back on track. It's to punish them for what happened with Fassone and Mirabelli, and also to show other clubs, say, look, you can't do this. It's not you face the consequences. So aside from that, I think for Milan, it went pretty well. The $12 million fine is their money from the Europa League. This season, they're going to have a limited squad of 21 players. They have 3 years to balance the budget. And look, you know, maybe they can take a page out of what Inter did. If I was Milan, I'd really focus on my youth system, get some pretty decent youth team players, and then sell them from Massive Plus Valencia, which is basically what Inter did to get out of the hole. And so maybe it wasn't that bad. So now I promise to get off my soapbox for the next question, Alex.
All right, David, next Twitter question. Will Milan getting eliminated from the Europa League prove to be a blessing in disguise and just help Milan get back to the Champions League?
I think so. And the reason I say that is especially because Milan had so many injuries. Now, you know, say Milan was at full strength. Say they didn't lose Biglia. Say they didn't lose Romagnoli. Say they didn't lose Musacchio. Say Conti was healthy, then yeah, it'd be very disappointing that Milan's out of the Europa League. But they've had like a tiny squad. I think Gattuso, and look, you know, he's also been helped by the fact the other teams were pretty poor, that he's still there in fourth place alone. But, you know, the margin for error is really small when you have such a limited squad. So considering the situation, I think it would have been impossible for Milan to continue to compete in multiple fronts. So I am going to say it's a blessing in disguise. Also, those games on Thursday don't really help. Be curious to see how Lazio handles this moving forward. But when you got to think that for fourth place in and of itself, it does give Milan a slight edge that they're out of it and Lazio's still in.
All right, David, next Twitter question. For me, Rust in Peace is the best metal album of all time. Can you change my mind?
So that isn't you, Alex. I never pictured you as a Megadeth listener. I forget the name of the listener who sent that in. I appreciate it's the same guy that sent the Milan question. So shout out to him, and sorry I didn't mention him. So actually, I got a kick out of this question because last week, the lead singer for Megadeth, or that's the band that has Rust in Peace, Dave Mustaine, absolutely dunked on me on Twitter. Like, he did this interview on SiriusXM, and, you know, he started a feud with the former lead guitarist Friedman that was on Rust in Peace, and there was going to be a back and forth. So I tweeted at Sirius, and Dave Mustaine was on the tweet. I was like, huh, I smell a reunion tour or a book coming, because the Rolling Stones, every time they're getting ready for a tour, Mick and Keith start a little feud there. And he just replied to me, he goes, you're totally wrong. He goes, I don't know what clues you're getting. So it was pretty good. We had a pretty good back and forth. So it's been on my mind, so I'm glad you asked. So I will say, for me, Rust in Peace is definitely the best Megadeth album. It's the best Megadeth lineup, with Friedman on lead guitar. Menza was a great drummer who unfortunately passed away. To me, that was definitely the best Megadeth lineup. They got a little bit more commercial later on, but that one's really a classic thrash album. I think Holy War is the Punishment Due is really one of the best metal songs of all time. So look, you know, music is subjective. It's definitely, for good reason, one of the most influential metal albums ever. You know, is it the best? Hard for me to say. You know, what I really enjoy about it is, like, what an intelligent record that is. Both the lyrics, there's a lot of really good social commentary on it. The guitar playing is unreal. So I kind of always saw it as a, you know, more elevated genre. I mean, I love Slayer, but I would say this is a little bit different. Like, Slayer are really technical in different ways, a little bit more polished. So I'm with the listener. Rust in Peace is definitely a fantastic album.
All right, David, last Twitter question. Did you enjoy The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, and where do you rank it amongst the Coen brothers' films?
Yeah, so this is a little preview because, like I said, on the next podcast, we're going to go deep into movies with our friend Andrew Barker. This is the time of year where I watch a lot of movies. I'm really not into the popcorn blockbusters. Netflix now has a lot of these good movies. So the Coen brothers released this movie, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, on Netflix. So I will say, if you want to get into the Coen brothers, they've done a ton of movies. They're probably amongst the most influential filmmakers, definitely alive now, amongst the best ever. I will say, if you kind of want to get into the Coen brothers and understand why people like them so much, this is a great movie to do it. What I like about this movie is it's like a short story book. You know how some authors, instead of doing a long novel, just do like short story collection. This is what it is. It's six small stories. They, you know, go from 20 minutes to 40 minutes each. Small vignettes, as you would say. They're all, for the most part, really, really entertaining. Some are really funny. Some of them are really pretty sad. Some of them almost have like a Twilight Zone vibe to it, especially the last one and the one about the miner that's looking for gold. It kind of really had like a surreal Twilight Zone vibe to it. So I really, really enjoyed it. I will say, to me, it had a lot of staples of what makes the Coen brothers fantastic. The cinematography is incredible. This was done by Bruno Dubonel. He's done previously Inside Llewyn Davis with the Coen brothers. Last year, he did Darkest Hour, the movie on Winston Churchill, which had unreal cinematography. So the images are fantastic, and I give them even more credit because this isn't on the big screen in a movie theater. This is on Netflix, and it just looks beautiful. I've watched it both on my iPad and on my big TV, and it looked just fantastic both ways. So a lot of cool stories and moves. Even if you find one story a little bit boring, it won't last too long, and you will get to the other ones. As far as where I rank it with the Coen brothers, it's not as good as their top masterpieces. To me, Fargo, Big Lebowski are really kind of in their own category. This other movie that I've been getting into recently, because I've been on a big Coen brothers kick, is A Serious Man. I think in years past, I watched it with my wife and I fell asleep. Then I watched it again recently. It's fantastic, but it's definitely nothing like Fargo and Big Lebowski. It's a little bit more intellectual, but I think if you kind of want to, but the Ballad of Buster Scruggs is really Coen Brothers for beginners, and I say that in a good way. So this is today's show. I want to thank everyone who sent in questions. I want to thank you guys for leaving reviews. That's the best Christmas present for Alex and I that you can do. We are a free podcast. We count on you to grow. So if you have yet to leave us a review on iTunes, please do. Please tweet your friends to let them know about the podcast. If you have questions for Thursday shows, please use the Couchland hashtag, and we look forward to chatting with you then.